we get the hour going, as we do each Tuesday, by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His newest book is a terrific read. It is called Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. It's available on Amazon and wherever you buy quality reading materials. Colin, good afternoon.
What is up, Mr. Kimball?
Well, you know, just getting back at it here after a three-day weekend. I see you spent a little quality time at Walden Pond.
I did, yes. I was out there on whatever it was before Game 3. That was Sunday, and I took the train and walked around the pond, walked out to the pond. See, I don't have a car, so it's a matter of taking the MBTA and then hoofing it out there Thoreau style. And did about 10 miles after running 3,000 stairs, came home and watched a little baseball.
Yeah, let's talk about that. And we're not on our agenda today, but I know you can pivot. You can go anywhere. This Red Sox team, you and I have conversed about this both on the air and privately. They can be a frustrating team. They're a terrible fundamental team, but something about them, they find ways to win.
They do, and I don't know what that thing is, because it's not defense, it's not fundamentals, like you said. I don't even know that it's character. I don't think they're necessarily the most resilient bunch. I think that they have their peaks and their valleys, and they can sometimes get things going the right way. It's just sort of like the math of the arrangement, and here they are right now. But I will say, I have to strut about this a little bit, because so many of my sports predictions are wrong. On Twitter, you can go back, people, and look at this. I was dead right in how this series would have to play out for them to advance. It's exactly what happened. They'd have to get one out of those two in Tampa, which your boy Chris Sale did everything in his powers, as per usual, to prevent, the gutless wonder. And I thought they'd have to win it in Boston. I felt if they went back for a game five, they were probably going to lose. And they almost gave away both of the games, where I felt like in the two games they won in Boston, they pulled a Rays. In other words, the Rays have this tendency to just control the entire game from start to finish, to assert their will over you. And I felt like the Red Sox did that for the most part in both games, and yet there they were on the cusp of losing. But I'll tell you when I felt really good. It was after game one, when Cora said what he did about the quality at bats the Red Sox were having, because he doesn't normally say things like that. And then when I saw that popcorn thing, Kimball, that made me want to lower my shoulder and pop someone through the glass. I was ready to go. And I was thinking, like, no, really, how dumb are you? That's like so disrespectful. It's so hubristic. And you just are giving someone like a challenge and an invitation to knock your proverbial block off.
Yeah, absolutely. And don't think for a moment that the Red Sox didn't find out about that. And that wasn't in the back of their minds as they continue to come back and win the series. And hey, all bets are off the table now. I won't be shocked to see them beat the Houston Astros.
I have a lot of respect, and I've had it for a while now. I'm not saying he's some awesome pitcher. I'm on the record saying that he's serviceable plus. Sometimes he's like a B-plus type of pitcher, and I think that's really his ceiling. But I have a lot of admiration for Nathan Eovaldi. Some guys in this life, Kimball, you know this, they're just winners. Chris Sale is a loser. He's not a winner. He's a head case. He can't handle the pressure. Eovaldi, if you remember, in that ALDS in 2018 when they went to New York and the series was tied, he was the one who, in the Bronx, shut down the Yankees. And then, of course, he had that, whatever it was, six innings of relief when he was just kind of the lamb at the slaughter. So you knew he was going to give it up eventually in that game three against the Dodgers. And though they lost that game, that was the game that told me the Red Sox are going to win this. I would have given the series, the World Series MVP award to Eovaldi simply for that. I mean, he has the balls as big as grapefruits. I admire that guy a lot, and I felt good that they had him going in that game three when Tampa came to Boston. Well, and don't forget, too, Fenway was jumping. Fenway was like, that was making up for lost time. Even like kind of in the sort of glory days, that's like a 2004 type of crowd that you had at Fenway. Right. And I think that was important, too, because it became a very difficult place to play.
Well, and you heard Kike Hernandez say that last night when they started chanting my name. My confidence grew. And with Eovaldi, man, I love him. And then yesterday, after 85 pitches the night before, he walked into Cora's office and said, if you need me for an inning, I'm good to go.
grapefruits. And what I've noticed about him, too, is he was throwing, like, whatever he was throwing, 100-plus a few years ago. But he was the rare guy who threw 100-plus who wasn't a strikeout pitcher. Because that was the pitch that he had. Mm. It was really, like, his main arsenal. And then he developed secondary pitches, I feel like. That split finger that he uses, where he became a strikeout guy. That's what he is now. And he wasn't a strikeout guy previously. So I think he has a lot more going for him as a starter. Although I think Cora, when he took him out in that game, you never want to make it feel like if you're the other team, you're doing them a favor. And I felt like that was the favor when they lifted Eovaldi. At least let him get himself into a mild predicament. Because then you're moving everyone up in the line. You're asking different things of people. When you can ask things of them later in the game, and also cut out two or three of them,
yes,
who maybe aren't the Garrett Whitlocks of the world. But, I mean, it was as satisfying a series win with house money, like I wrote about on Twitter, in a long time. I wasn't a huge fan of that 2018 team. I thought they were like the 07 Patriots. I thought they were overrated, and they almost won at the end despite themselves because their stars didn't perform. But I definitely enjoyed those last two games.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about another Red Sox series. The 1986 American League Championship Series against the California Angels.
Game 5. I think I might have mentioned Game 6 to you in our correspondence, for which I apologize, because they're usually like the great games. They're usually Game 6 is 86, 75. But, of course, the key game in that series in the 86 ALCS is Game 5, which occurred on this very day, 1986. I remember it because I was going into hockey practice. I think it was in Taunton, Massachusetts. So we're outside the rink in the parking lot. My dad and I were listening to the game, and it just sucked. It was done. It wasn't like over, but it was over. it was just bleak. And I remember, like, that was kind of the team of my youth. I just turned 11. So that was my 67 Red Sox. I know it's like not as sexy a pick type of thing, but you're the age you are when you're that particular age. And I remember we were on invocation in like New Hampshire. We didn't have a lot of money, and that's like where we went, to like North Conway and Santa's Village and stuff. And we got, my dad and I, a complete set of the 1986 Topps Red Sox. And I remember my dad saying, and this is like whatever, June, he's like, they have a chance to win the pennant this year. And when my dad said that, it was like the Oracle had spoken. He didn't normally say things of that nature. So there we were, sort of coming full circle, and we're in the parking lot, and it was awful. I went into practice, and my dad went into the stands and watched me, and I'm sure he's getting updates from people. I come out of the locker room afterwards, it's like the Red Sox won. And I'm thinking, like, you sad old BSer. you need to be. I was so hopeless. I didn't believe him. I really thought for the first time in my life, kind of like shattering illusions, that my father was lying to me. So it's like really this sort of like complicated, like Oedipal thing I had going on. But then, of course, the circumstances of the game, and it just was as bad as the World Series was for the Red Sox. They really shouldn't have gotten there. And I think what sometimes is overlooked with the comeback, with the Dave Henderson home run, the big three run, it looks like they're going to now win the game. And the Angels, they tie the game in the bottom of the ninth, because this was in California. This was in Anaheim. And they get the bases loaded with, I think, just one out. So all they need is, like, next to nothing. Kind of like last night. You just need like that sack fly or that dribbler that's not hit hard enough to turn to. And the Red Sox somehow got out of it. And I remember at the time that the Red Sox players themselves, I think they almost said it directly, if not actually saying it directly, they knew if they're coming back to Boston for two games, the Angels had no shot whatsoever. And they crushed them when they got back to Boston.
Two big heroes in that game, too, that get forgotten because of the Henderson heroics, or Rich Gedman, who had a great game. A couple of years later, I was working at his baseball camp down at Babson College, and I said, Geddy, best hit by pitch in Red Sox history when he got hit and was on base when Hendu hit that home run. But also Steve Crawford, Shag Crawford, getting him out of that ninth inning rally coming out of the bullpen.
One of those weird like heroes that you never otherwise remember for anything else. I feel like one from the like 2004 AL Championship Series in Game 4, Curtis Lysanek. It was like the last.
Oh, yes, yes.
Right. They were so desperate. So you become like that really cool like footnote. And I think people almost think Lenny DiNardo was that footnote, but because he was on the 04 team. He never pitched for the Red Sox in the postseason.
Right.
He only like pitched a little bit into June. He had like 15 appearances with the Red Sox. Like he was barely on them more than I was. And so it's almost like a kind of like shoving him into that like assumed hero role. But it was that very star-crossed Angels team. And of course they were managed by it was like 661 at the time. But to me, he was the oldest man in the world.
Oh, yes.
Mark. Yeah. That's how I thought of him. I thought, like, he's baseball Yoda. Like, he's just 800. He's supernatural. And he had had a long history. For people who don't know this, you can look it up of, well, what we used to call being a goat, being a choker, manager style. So they had all kinds of, like, bad juju, despite having, like, Reggie Jackson and his positive postseason karma. A lot of good players on that team. Doug Sensei's and guys who I believe might have made the flyout that didn't score that would have been winning run in the bottom of the ninth. But it was a really exciting series. I mean, both of the series, the championship series, were in 86. I mean, even maybe the other one, which didn't go seven, was perhaps more intense between the Astros and the Mets. But it was a fun team. Roger Clemens doing his thing at the time. And like you said, Gettman and in 85, Gettman had, like, his best year by far. In 86, he's still, like, a plus player, but it's the last time he's going to be that. Like, his career is essentially over. Like, he's shot. I don't know why. After 86.
Well, I think it was the Charlie Lau influence that top hand started flying off the bat, and he lost his power.
He did. And he, yeah, you're right, because now I can see in my mind's eye his swing. And he just had, like, almost like the cartoonish exaggeration of that hand flying off. And other guys used it too and were successful with it, because I remember
Wade Boggs,
Fisk, another catcher, he started employing it. But I don't remember anyone ever really looking like Gettman. And then they get to like 88, and it's almost like a platoon type of thing. And so he was this up and coming. I think he made what, two all-star teams? So he would have made the all-star team. There would have been a bunch of Red Sox on it in 86. He must have been there. But I know Fisk wasn't on that team, so there must have been another slot that was open. But for me, like I said, it was like the 67 Red Sox where you can go around and talk about, oh, Spike Owen. Like, I know weird, like, Spike Owen career statistics. And when I look at them on Baseball Reference, it kind of makes me sad that he wasn't very good, because I want him to be more than he was. I want to be like, he was actually a dark horse MVP candidate that year. But again, for Spike Owen, I have to go back to his college days as a teammate of Roger Clemens to do that. But and Clemens seemed larger than life, which is ironic now, because Dwight Gooden the year before had probably the greatest season the starting pitcher has ever had in baseball. So Clemens wasn't even like close to what Gooden had been just the prior campaign. But it was 20 games over 500, man. That's nuts. That's something like you might never see again. I mean, it's tough enough to even get to 15 wins the way things happen now. So he just seemed like this Herculean figure.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's shift gears and talk about a new short story that is out in Post Road Magazine, called The Last Field. Wow. I don't know what it was about this story, but it painted such a picture in my mind. The prose, I wrote this down because this line was so beautiful. Sometimes you have to bail out the oceans that flood your heart in wine glasses rather than buckets.
It's funny you mention that, because, so this is, for me, I have to qualify this. This is actually a fairly old story that's come out now. And what happened with it was, it was accepted by Harper's when Find the Edges was accepted. And then that editor-in-chief lost his job. And so the story became orphaned, and the Atlantic was going to publish it. And they did what they did, which I've written about in the blog, and they've banned me now, where the editor at the time, he passed it off to someone else, and she rejected it, like unaccepted it with like five words, because she was going to publish some hot bleep Argentinian woman writer, because that's how decisions are made. It has nothing to do with the work. And then when I said something about that, you get summarily banned. And then another place called the Kenyon Review was going to publish it. And they come out six times a year, and they were going to put it up on their website, which is like where they put relative beginners, not people who have a career anywhere approaching mine. And I said something like that. And they banned me for life because of that. I mean, these are the kind of like sociopathic bigots that you're dealing with. So eventually it ends up in Post Road, and I had largely repressed it. And someone had put up on my Facebook author page, they'd quoted that line you actually quoted. And when I experience these stories I've written, even if it's one I've written today, like the one I wrote today, I read them like I'm that third person reader. I don't read them like I'm, oh, I did this, so I'm going to more likely be lenient towards myself. I'm able to have a kind of out-of-body reading experience. And so that can be with something new or can be with something older. And so I'm able to experience lines as though they were written by someone else. And I read something like that line you just mentioned, just thought, my goodness, that's the real deal. It's like the first sentence of the story, too. It's just, I think it's one of those all-timer first sentences of Fields, my father had three. And it's going to be the story about, well, it's about a number of things, but this guy's father is shooting himself, it appears, in these fields near his house. But it also becomes about something else, and really the death of his mother, and not just his mother's death, certainly, but the circumstances of her death and the very hands-on quality, I'll say, that he played with that particular death, and then also a kind of beatific kindness for her father. But it's something that he has to live with as he's trying to build, like, this fairly young man his own life. And it's in Cheer Pack, so it's in there with Find the Edges from Harper's and First Responder and all that stuff. But, yeah, the whole line about the heart and the bailing out, and when I sometimes look at a story like that, precisely a story, this story, I'm moved to somewhere else I haven't been in my life. I mean, this story takes place not anywhere I've lived. I know no one like these people. And it's that idea, again, of these characters. Sometimes with me, people will want like the chatty Kathy, like the blog, because they think they're getting like some access to me. They're getting pipeline information to a living person. But I could just be making that up. It could be an 85-volume novel I'm doing. It's just because you see I in me. There is nothing more real. I have no problem saying this. There's nothing more real in the history of the world than the characters in my stories, in a story like this. They're more real than me. They're more real than you. No offense. They're out there in the world in a larger way than anyone who is in the world could hope to be.
And I love the relationship with Mara, who is just this amazing person who accepts our narrator, meets him where he is, and
yes,
and doesn't have her her baggage, her expectations. She just likes this person for who he is and where he is in his life.
You had a comment once on The Cape Path, the first story in Buried on the Beaches, and you said that there's no, I thought it was quite astute, you said there's no judgment in this story. And there are certainly things that maybe other people would judge the behavior of these characters for, like with what helps one person get to a certain place in life they might not otherwise. It's very much that particular story. It's very much a story of life. And this is very much The Last Field, a story of life, but life through also a kind of loss. And sometimes I don't want to say that I write these characters, these female characters, as like almost wish fulfillment. Like I'd like to meet someone like that. But again, it does harden me that they're out there. And I think there's something to be said for understanding where someone is in their particular journey and not pressing too hard upon the pathways of that journey so that you restrict their process. Even if you might not be getting immediately what you need or what you think you need in that moment, you're allowed to await for a kind of dilation for what you have coming to you to eventually get there. And that's really having faith in another person. Like I have faith in these characters. I mean, like I said, in many ways they're beyond me because I don't invent their story. They exist and they're going to tell me the story. It's always from them that I get the story. It's never the other way around. I don't like try to put the pegs into the holes that are the wrong shape. They're always going to tell me, and that's exactly what she does. And you come to the end of the story and you think that this is a relationship that really could work. And even if it doesn't work, you're going to have two people who have had things added to their lives that they only each could have uniquely brought to their lives.
check out this wonderful story, The Last Field, Post Road. You can find it online at postroadmag.com. Colin Fleming with us. Let's talk some music. And my goodness, I had a great time listening to several nocturnes by the man who invented the form, John Field.
I like picturing you watching the Red Sox game deep in your cups, listening to nocturnes at night, and you're smoking vest, watering your ficus.
Well, it wasn't quite that. It was actually on my front porch in the afternoon, a pre-radio show yesterday, but reclining, taking it all in, even though it was not nighttime, I was still in a nocturnal mood.
Oh, that sounds like a man. It almost sounds like a Narragansett beer commercial starting off right there. You know, about to cross over into your yard.
Yeah. Hi, neighbor. And, have another.
So we go from one field to another, and this would be John Field, who was born in the early 1780s in Dublin. He's going to spend a lot of his life, though, in Russia. And he is the bona fide inventor of the nocturne. And the nocturne, for people who are familiar with them, it really means a night piece for piano, and it doesn't have a rigorous form like you'll get oftentimes in classical music. I look at it this way. You can use this, impress your father-in-law with this. It's the closest that classical music gets to jazz, because classical music certainly isn't about improvisation. Classical musicians don't like to improvise. But it has the feel of a Miles Davis ballad, like on solo trumpet, like elevator to the gallows type of thing, but for piano. And John Field was the guy who came up with this form. And then people like Chopin, of course, took to it. But these are mood pieces that are more than mood pieces. Because if you say, like, something's a mood piece, it almost feels like incidental music, like soundtrack for exit music for a film. So it's that, like, Radiohead idea, which they were satirizing in some ways. And so I was listening to these nocturnes again today. There are only a handful of them. There are less than 24 by this guy. And it was like the thing that really made his legacy. But night pieces that if you're sitting there and you don't have like the traffic noise outside, the construction has died down, put these on and they won't bore you. You might think like a mood piece is night piano. Can't be that exciting at all. But it is actually pretty exciting.
And then a different type of piano music of a jazz nature with a wonderful combo, including a guy we've talked about before, Eric Dolphy, along with Andrew Hill on piano. And from Point of Departure, a terrific piece called Dedication.
I would have had a good time in 1964 because a guy like me, I would have gone off and bought like A Hard Day's Night and Point of Departure by this jazz band. And I think you could make a real case. I'm in this camp myself, that this is the best small band ever assembled in jazz. And what's going to be especially neat about that is they just played on this afternoon. That's how jazz oftentimes works. I mean, you have like your road band maybe, and you go around. I just mentioned Miles Davis, and his second great quintet was getting going around this time, and they're going to do their thing going around the world. But Andrew Hill got these guys together. Like you said, Dolphy was there. Dolphy was just awesome at showing up at epochal sessions. That's what he did. And it wasn't just because he happened to be like on the team that's going to win the championship. He was oftentimes like the catalyst for why they were going to win the jazz championship, as it were. And so the song, Dedication, which closes the album, I mentioned it to you for now because it was one of those performances where they're done with it and everybody's just wrecked. Like, they're, like, crying. They're like, how could you do this to us, Andrew Hill? The original title of the song, I think it's the most haunted song in all of jazz history. The original title was Cadaver. And if people want to go out there and listen to this, you're not going to be like, that was a misnomer. You'd be like, no, Cadaver really could have worked. That's Cadaver, all right.
And finally, let's close it out this afternoon by going back to 1935. For a Universal Pictures version of Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven, an all-star cast with Karloff and Lugosi, but a film that was not a critical success.
No, it's a mess. Have you seen it?
I have, and I couldn't find it. I looked for it. I have it on a videotape somewhere, and it's one of those Universal Collection, and I think it's got two fairly bad films on the same videotape.
So it runs, well, it would fit. It only runs 61 minutes. I saw this guy on Facebook writing about it the other day. It's like, it's a masterpiece of concision storytelling. Like, people just say things. Like, it's obviously not. I mean, it's pretty terrible. I think the way I put it somewhere was it's the film, big budget film that Ed Wood would have made with funds. Like, it's so over the top. It's not over the top in the clever way that The Black Cat is from the previous year. I think it's pretty neat that Karloff is just billed as Karloff. Like, he's so cool. He just doesn't even, like, he's not like, get rid of the Boris. You don't need it. Karloff. And he's like this 60-year-old kind of frail-looking man who becomes, it's like a sort of odd bogeyman. And this was one of the Lugosi-Karloff pairings. But it's really the only one where Lugosi has the bigger part. And I don't know if, I mean, he's not exactly like the master of acting, Lugosi. It's all about the brows and the beetling brows and the accent and the thunderous intonations. And I mean, he's one of my favorites. I'll watch Lugosi in anything. But he's not a subtle actor.
No.
Not like, oh, what a rich characterization that was. Whereas Karloff, he can do that. And Lugosi, I don't know, like, if he looked at the script and he thought, awesome, I get to say the word torture 124 times. He just says torture over and over again. Like, if you tried to do a drinking game to torture, you'd be like, uh-oh, it's 9/11. I have the alcohol poison again. I was just watching that Raven. It's like, it has so little to do with the Raven. They're just like, okay, Lugosi, do a couple lines, and we'll have a stuffed bird on your desk. That's all it is.
Well, check it out for yourself if you can find a copy of it. It is on 1935's The Raven with Bela Lugosi and Karloff. And, of course, read postroadmag.com and check out The Last Field. And if you haven't yet, what are you waiting for? Get your hands on Collins' latest book from the 33 and a Third series, Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Colin, thanks as always. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good.